All right, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, Lindsay Park. John told me specifically not do that, but I just did. No clapping after my name. To my right is the famous, the infamous, the never to be repeated, John Larson.
Hi, Lindsay.
John, how many more episodes are left?
There's eight. Eight aww, more episodes.
Everyone say, aww. Well, we're glad to have
you. Except most people are listening in the future, so that doesn't make any sense.
That's all right. Maybe the future can compel you to come back somehow.
No, I doubt it.
Time warp. Also with us tonight is the lovely Katrine.
Hello, Lindsay.
We know her from Mormon Expression Voices.
Yes. Should I put a plug in right here for Voices?
Do it.
Okay. If you want to be on Voices, please send me an email at voices@mormonexpression.com. I say no to no one. So let me know if you want to tell us your story.
All right. Thank you. And back for another is Misha. Misha, can you say hello?
Hello.
She came all the way from Provo.
I did.
All the way up here.
Indeed.
Yeah, so before we get started, we have a few announcements to make. I'll let Katrine go first.
Okay, we have a couple relationship class coming up soon. It's for those that find themselves in a transition or a different religion than your spouse or the couple in your relationship. It's hosted or given by fabulous Jenny Morrow, who is a marriage and family therapist. There are two sessions. One is November 15th from 10 to 12:30, and then November 17th from 7 to 9:30. It's only $25 per person, which is a fantastic price and well worth it. I promise Jenny will help you in ways you didn't know you needed helping with. And you can send an email to lindsay@mormonexpression.org or .com.
No, it's lindsay@whitefieldseducational.org.
Okay, send it there, and we will give you the information you need and get you signed up.
Yeah, and so just for those who are listening in the future, if you are listening in the past, you're going to have this email address to contact me. It'll be me and Katrine that are running that account, because Katrine is actually helping take over counseling services because my job at Sunstone has gotten really busy. So thank you, Katrine.
Sure.
Okay, John, what have you got for us tonight?
All right. Well, of course, you know, we said eight episodes that I'm stepping down from the Mormon Expression seat. And Mormon Expression pays for this lovely studio and community center that we're sitting in that allows things like Jenny's group sessions and the other community classes we do. Also, Voices is recorded here. Reasonability is recorded here. There's actually other podcasts that have been recorded here from time to time that have nothing to do with what we're doing. But without Mormon Expression, we fear we'll no longer be able to afford the studio. So last week, I announced that we were starting a Kickstart campaign, although we ran into problems with Kickstart. They really don't fund nonprofits. They fund, like, if you're trying to make shit that will never work or go to market. That's what Kickstart is for. But we found an alternative. I'm getting it finalized. If you go to MormonExpression.com, or the Facebook page, hopefully by the time this releases, it should be up and running. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to gather the operational cost for this community center for 2015. And we're setting the goal of $9,000, which basically covers the cost of this for an entire year. And if we reach that goal, what we plan on doing is then opening this center up for no charge to anybody who's doing any community activity really that falls within our that matches our ethics, our goals, our purpose for being, which is to help people do other stuff besides religion. So it's pretty fucking broad of what you can get away with in here. It can't be illegal.
We were growing pot earlier. I probably should have asked you about that.
Oh, no, that's not allowed. Oh. Not allowed. So I would encourage everybody who's enjoyed the podcast, wants to pay it forward, to go ahead and donate to that campaign.
It is a lovely studio. Am I right? Yes.
Yeah.
So, but also, I think everybody should give a Misha?
Yes.
Where can people find you? Do you blog? Do you post? What do you do?
I try to hide is what I do. So I'm a full-time PhD student. I'm getting my PhD in counseling psychology at BYU. So doing a lot of research and trying to get through school. And on occasion, I'll blog over at Feminist Mormon Housewives and
podcast there.
And podcast
there. What's your moniker over there? Do you want to give it out?
I think it's just my name.
She's legit.
She doesn't hide behind a shroud of darkness.
Who would do that?
It's just
only
Misha
posers
McGriggs, so.
And losers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we won't tell. We all won't tell BYU you're here.
Thank you.
Katrine, obviously, on Voices, doing a fantastic job over there. You have any other projects?
Announcement.
Nothing worth talking about.
Well, okay. And, of course, Winterbottom, or what is that? What?
Wow.
Winter Sunshine.
John, I'm so flattered that you follow my work. Yes, Winterbottom here.
Isn't it something like that?
Something like that, yes.
Winter Buzz, right?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it. It's an embarrassing name that we made up back in the day when we were all scared of stuff.
Well, I just gave you a new one if you want to change it to something cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
Like Winterbottom. It's Winterbottom coming live at you. So, yes, I have stuff to promote.
Yes, go ahead.
Your favorite Mormon Expression host, not me, John Larson, is going to be speaking at our Singles in the Borderlands conference on December 6th in Salt Lake City. It's a conference that is addressing topics about being single in the Borderlands. And actually, Misha, who is on the panel, will be speaking there as well. And so I've had this question, do you have to be a single person to attend? Absolutely not. This is going to be for some of us dummy Mormons and ex-Mormons who still are locked into that whole marriage dynamic paradigm where we say offensive things. In fact, I think when I asked John to speak, I probably framed it in a really offensive way.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, so it's for single people or people who want to meet single people, we could say, right?
Yeah, I guess we can say that. Because really, all we really want this conference for is to hook people up because people shouldn't be single.
It's like the duck of Utah.
Is that
too an obscure reference?
Duck Beach, I got it, baby. Okay, so that's December 6th. It's going to be hosted. The Community of Christ Church Building always generously hosts our stuff, so it's going to be there, and you guys should come.
And you regularly broadcast or podcast on Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast.
Yes, if you like polygamy. We talk quite a bit about polygamy.
And who doesn't like polygamy? And you, of course, blog at Feminist Mormon Housewives.
Yes, true.
And you're a regular pundit these days. The news media is always picking up on you. You were one of the featured, like, top 10, what did they call you, in City Weekly a couple weeks ago?
Oh, I was a Mormon Avenger. That was a
Mormon Avenger, yes.
Yeah. Isn't that a cool name? Like, I will take it. I will take that one.
Yeah, it's like being a Danite. Congratulations.
It's like the Danite, except for I don't kill people. Dang. Not yet. That's right. So, yeah. Oh, should we get into the news?
Let me promote my last name. This was all ruse so I could promote my shit.
Oh, I see where we were going.
If you still want to follow me or hear what I'm doing lately, you can head over to johnlarson.org. And you can go to the johnlarsonpodcast.com.
Do I go there for porn? Because that's really the only reason I get on the internet.
We can talk later. I don't know.
Okay, well, yeah. Check it out, and because John has some good projects in the works for the future. Okay, so let's get into the news. There are some fantastic news stories, at least news stories that excite me. But let's talk about the new Mormon curriculum. Now, I first thought this was an old story because we've been talking about revamping the whole seminary curriculum. But John pointed out it's actually in the Tribune today, and today is October 28th. So, John, do you want to tell us a little bit about what's going on with the new Mormon curriculum?
Well, the church apparently has announced that they're revamping particularly the institute curriculum, which used to be the church's equivalent of higher learning. And there would be manuals that were associated with the scriptures, so the DNC manual and the Book of Mormon manual. And they've changed it to Sunday schoolize or proof text everything and really dumb it down another level. If you could imagine that, they're dumbing it down another level. Well, what's interesting here is many of the insiders and scholars and those who've been associated with apologetics for a long time have turned on the mother church on this one, particularly, Daniel Peterson's bulldog, Bill Hamblin, has gone on the
perfectly rational, reasonable, even-killed, thoughtful scholar, Bill Hamblin?
That's the guy. And he has attacked the church, for heaven's sakes.
He did. He said, and this is quoted in the Salt Lake Tribune, he called the new curriculum appalling. And he said, it will result in the further decay of spiritual literacy, already a significant problem among the saints. Scripture study in the church has now become nothing more than completely decontextualized proof texting.
Yeah, it's true. He's absolutely, we were arguing about this before, he's absolutely right.
He did call the Maxwell Institute the Sunstone South, which I was flattered by.
Wait, he's still a little pissed off that they fired Dan Peterson and those guys from Maxwell Institute. So there's these warring factions of these insider scholars who have been doing apologetics. Bill Hamblin, we haven't talked about these guys very much because I frankly don't think they deserve it. Robert Millett and Bill Hamblin and these guys,
again, perfectly reasonable, rational scholars.
They had a long run in the 80s and 90s of really dirty apologetics and, really, ad hominem to the max, and you can pick up some of these. They just go read their book of their review.
They started a new one. It's called The Interpreter.
Oh, but they had that for a long time. The Maxwell Institute, which used to be off campus, used to be just right south of BYU. Then under Hinckley, got acquired and moved onto campus. And then there's always been internal infighting, but it's really been a loose scholarship. Heavy sort of attack. And it's usually used by Mormons to say, see, look, here's an article about that the scholars have dealt with this, so you don't have to worry about it. And that's really been its purpose, is to show that there are smart people out there who've written some kind of article to deal with the hard issues.
Yeah, Bill Hamblin put down his painting, his John McNaughton painting, long enough to give a quote to the Salt Lake Tribune about this. You can go read about it. And then he wrote a second blog post. Oh, I thought you raised your hand. Sorry. So, yeah. So, that, do you guys want to say anything? I'm sorry if anyone is an avid reader of The Interpreter.
I don't think Hamblin teaches at BYU anymore.
He does not.
So, yeah.
That's a fun story that we won't talk about today. So let's go with the next news story. This is a story I'm really excited about. The church published and released three essays, making four essays on plural marriage, polygamy. They have one that contextualizes all of them, and then they have one for the Nauvoo-Kirtland period, one for the Utah period, and one for the Manifesto.
They're still chuckle-worthy. I read them this afternoon, and I got the giggles. they still use a lot of weasel words and things they couldn't possibly know. And, you know, like they crawl into people's heads and it's just, they can't just write an article.
So I'm going to be going on Mormon Stories to talk about this. Again, we already talked about the Kirtland Nauvoo essays, but we're going to talk about the Utah one. I have to tell you, if you guys are interested in a fun read, and maybe I'm just a polygamy nerd, so you have to rein me in here, but read the Utah period essay and then look at the footnotes, because the footnotes directly contradict everything that the essay says. Like, for example, it'll be like, yeah, polygamous marriages, you know, were to bring more children into the fold. More children came out of polygamous marriages, footnote 6. Then you look at footnote 6 and it says, actually, monogamous marriages, studies have shown that monogamous marriages had more children than polygamous marriages. I'm like, why did you put it in there then? It's fantastic. It's riddled with stuff like that.
Because nobody reads the footnotes. Who would take the time?
No one's going to read these essays. They're super hard to find. You have to, like, click with a link within a link.
Yeah, and, you know, here's the other story. Maybe not. It's all over my news feed by people who should be doing something else with their time. Quit reading this shit, guys. Go out and play baseball or something.
But where
have to see. That's why I have to retire.
No, you should read it. You should read it because it's super fascinating.
It's okay. Yeah. All right. Well,
and then you should listen to my podcast.
All of us aren't in a healthy place like you are, John. We need to obsess and pick it apart until there's nothing left.
There's nothing new in here that hasn't been widely published since at least the 70s, and really widely known since the 90s.
But they do some bold things. They mention Helen Mar. Of course, they say They don't say she's 14. They say a few months before her 15th birthday.
Well, it sounds so much better.
It's not untrue. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like how they say they were married, but who knows if they really had sex? We don't know. We can't tell, right?
It's true. There is no sex tape. Yes.
So... Here's the thing. The serious question I have is: there have been people who have written and talked about this stuff who have been seriously disciplined by the church for saying exactly what the church said. Where's the "I'm sorry"? Where's the "we're wrong"? We're going to walk back everything we said. I mean, that's what shows that they're still insincere. That this is all a bullshit game. That they've lost the war and now they're just trying to save face as they march back from Poland, and they're in trouble.
Really?
That was a Napoleonic reference. God damn it!
Okay. Just I wanted to make sure we're not going anywhere. That you're not supposed to be going tonight.
Napoleon. Heaven's sakes! Don't you listen to ABBA? All right. So, yeah, this was. The church going out, but the church is not cleaning up its own mess. The church is not still taking responsibility. They're like a child.
Yeah, well, like I said, I have a lot to say on this, but I am saying a lot, so I'm not going to use this space to say it. But you can check out the Mormon Stories episodes or Feminist Mormon Housewives. Do you guys want to say anything on these?
I just think that this stuff has been known for a long time, what they're saying. But at the same time, there is this huge group of people that have no idea. I was sitting with a friend and was, oh, did you hear about the new essay? What essay? Well, the church has been putting out essays. They've been putting out essays. Like, just like, no idea. Wait, Joseph Smith practiced polygamy? What? Yes.
Average Mormon does not know about these essays.
Right. The average Mormon just does not know. And it's...
Maybe Bill Hamblin is right. We're all really stupid.
No, it's true. The church is throwing this over the heads of its members and communicating to an outside force. And I have friends who, believe it or not, monitor the church's website constantly real time and look for any character change. Like if they change a T to an H, they pick that stuff up. But that's not what Mormons are doing, right? At all. And it's really kind of comical. And that's part of the reason I think the church is actually writing the essays is if you go on to like, YouTube, let's say we go to Brother Mike Norton's YouTube channel, you'll see hundreds and hundreds of comments from people who don't understand their own church, don't understand their own doctrine, saying these are lies, lies, lies. And I think that there's a whole generation of kids, this goes back to last week when they released the garment video, because there's a whole generation of kids that were denying this out there saying, I've been to the temple. I don't see these weird hats and veils you're talking about. And then bam, they go get an endowment and it hits them like a bat to the face, right? So the church realizes it's got to deal with this problem.
I will say that my stats are up on my polygamy, your polygamy site, about 10,000 each day. So my page views. So, and that's different than the downloads. So it's been a great week for me. This is fantastic. But, people are searching it. They're searching it. I can see the search words. I'm sure if we looked at Mormon Expression, I bet your polygamy episodes are up as well.
And the ones who aren't are busy doing more important things, like watching Meet the Mormons. So
that's important. Have you seen that?
Important work.
I have not.
I saw it because I didn't want to bash it before I saw it.
Is it still in theaters?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I went on a Friday afternoon. I had a meeting canceled in the afternoon, so I said, I'll go and watch it. And it was filled in the middle of the afternoon. I was like, don't you people work? Filled with people in shirts and ties, like they were going to general conference. Dresses, shirts, and ties. I walked in and probably looked like an investigator because I had like a hoodie on and black and the whole thing. And so, but I was like, are we at church or are we at the Cinemark? Like it was strange. It was very strange.
So is this a movie like where Uchtdorf is flying the plane and like jumps down parachutes with like a machete through the forest?
Kind of. Yeah. That's kind of like, you know, they're like, yes, we're awesome. And we left knowing that we're awesome. And that was awesome. So
is it the church's own distribution company? Like, do they own the distribution? Like, can we get it at Broovies? This is where I'm going at. I want to sponsor a screening at Broovies.
So I know that it, I mean, I don't know how, I know the church is, this is the church's project. Cause I know a woman in the movie and she said that this was the church after she talked to one of the producers and was like, who are you guys? Where are you from? And they were like, oh, here's my card. Like, we're the church. So the church has actually produced this. It was going to be in the Legacy Theater. And then they're like, you know what? Let's just do a whole feature film and put it on the big screen.
That was a really smart idea.
Very smart. It, you know, propaganda came to mind, but, or good marketing. I don't know. One of the two.
You got to go onto Rotten Tomatoes and read the comments, the positive comments. They're better than the consumer reviews on Three Wolf Moon t-shirt on Amazon. But these aren't satire. These are real. That you'll read how blessed you have a Three Wolf Moon shirt, Lindsay?
I that is something that is yet I have yet to purchase.
What's the other one on Amazon? You have to read that gallon of milk. I would say I'll post links out, but I say that on this podcast.
I would just like to use this moment to point out that John is just saying that you guys have better things to do than researching polygamy online, and he's pointing you to look at customer reviews on a gallon of milk.
It's fantastic.
I just want to throw that out there.
Thousands of reviews on Amazon on this gallon of milk.
That is how I'm going to waste tomorrow afternoon.
You'll thank me. I'll get a call in the afternoon and you'll thank me. It's better than talking about polygamous.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is a listener-supported production. Visit our website, mormonexpression.com, to tip John's swear jar or become a subscriber and help keep the show running. Thank you very much. We can't do it without you.
All right.
Oh, you stop that. Okay, so let's get into our episode. The reason why I'm hosting, I think some people are disappointed that we're not doing our DNC topic, but we are...
Oh, today was supposed to be King James English.
Oh, well, we're not doing that. We're doing something even more fun. It's part two. That's why I brought Misha back, and Katrina's filling in for Bill. Bill wanted to be here, but Bill wants to come and do a third, and I don't know if he can fit in a third one of these.
You know, in 2 weeks, we are doing the Red Scare. And Bill might be a perfect candidate for that. So
that's a good idea. Well, we are going to talk about part two of the top 10 lesser known scandals and rumors of Mormonism. So let's get into our list. We have a really fun list. And you guys, this is the thing. This is why I disagree with John. You can leave the church, but don't leave Mormon history alone. There's so many gold nuggets out there. So it was really hard to narrow this down because I even learned some stuff, like one that we were going to do, but we couldn't find enough information, was Marky Peterson's wanting to get rid of the all-seeing eye in all the temples. So there's all kinds of great stuff out there. So let's get started. Misha, do you want to bring us in with number one?
Sure. So the first one is are the baseball baptisms. So this is talking about the missionary efforts from 1959 to 1963. And I've always had a little bit of an issue with just what missionary work looks like today. It seems to be a little bit sales pitchy, a little bit pressury. Like the first time they're saying, the first discussion, they're saying you want to get baptized and that type of a thing. And so that's always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. But then when I read about this, I was like, oh, it could be worse, because it was worse. So at this time, Elder Henry D. Moyle was the general authority who was in charge of missionary efforts and missionary work all over the world. And he put a program together where they had 6 lessons and they were kind of filled with pressure. You would say, when we're having the baptism, we're baptizing people Saturday at 2. You want to be there? And so pushing this program. And along with this new program, there was all of this, like, a level of competition. So they would report the statistics as if you're reporting sports statistics. So the program kind of started in England. And then kind of spread throughout the world. But what was happening was that mission presidents were putting a lot of pressure on the missionaries to get a lot of baptisms. And then they were, you know, even kind of manipulating the numbers to be like, look what the other mission did, we can do better. And they were fudging the numbers a little bit to get the missionaries motivated. There was all sorts of incentive programs and rewards that you would get for the most number. So there's a lot of pressure. Well, what ended up happening is these young missionaries would go to lower socioeconomic status parts of town, and they would proselytize to young people. And young men, especially, was their aim. They had a disparity of men versus women joining the church. And because this is the 50s, women weren't breadwinners. And so the church had this deficit at the time. The church's finances were a hot mess at this time. And, so they needed money. And they thought, How can we make money? We got to have tithing. Who's going to be paying tithing? Young men. They're going to become breadwinners. They are going to, you know, bring in money and they're going to pay tithing. So let's focus on them. So missionaries are going to these poor neighborhoods in London, in parts of the Southeast United States that are poor areas, Samoa, and they're playing baseball. And they are talking to the kids, getting the kids excited. These are young adolescent kids. And they're promising them things like, if you get baptized in our church, then we'll take you on a trip to the ocean, for kids who are living near the Gulf of Mexico but never seen the ocean. And so they take them down to the ocean, baptize them so that they can see the ocean. They're telling kids things like, if you you want to play baseball against some Americans, you can go to America and have a baseball tournament against some Americans. We'll take you there, but you have to get baptized first. And so a lot of kids thought that they were actually joining a baseball club, and they didn't realize what they were doing. And so when this kind of got found out, and it was rubbing some people the wrong way, and some missionaries were going, ooh, I don't like this, and even some mission presidents were like, ooh, I don't know about all this.
Wait, I have a joke really quick.
Okay, please.
They were joining a baseball team in a way, because in Mormonism, it's like playing baseball, but you can't get to first base until you go to the temple. Okay, that was my joke.
So true, so true. So anyway, just kind of these tactics to get these kids to join, and the numbers were outstanding. They had all of these baptisms. But the thing that was happening was these kids didn't know what they were doing. Their parents were finding out, what, you joined a church? I thought you joined a baseball league. They were having baptisms down at the local YMCA. Parents were, I mean, in the East End of London, parents were so upset with the church that they would see missionaries and start throwing rocks at them to, like, get away from our children. And so basically what ended up happening was they kind of put a stop to this program and everything that they were doing. But at this time, the only way for these kids to get their names off the records of the church was by being excommunicated. So they would go and have to be excommunicated from a church that they didn't really realize they had joined. And it was just a messy, messy process. And yeah. So.
Yeah. I think interestingly enough, there is a doctrinal justification behind this. And Dr. Moyle spoke about it. And if you think about Mormonism, it sort of makes sense in a bizarre sort of way. In Mormon theology, when you get baptized, you get the gift of the Holy Ghost, right? So the philosophy was, just get them in the water as quickly as they can, and then the ones who are receptive to the Spirit will then feel the Spirit and will stay in the church. The remnants of that philosophy were still in the discussions when I was a missionary in the 90s. You know, this idea where you wanted to get them committed to baptism by the end of the second discussion, that you wanted to get them, there's manipulative language in the discussions, that what you feel is the Spirit. We'd show them tearjerker movies and then tell them they're feeling the Spirit and that sort of stuff. Now, you said that under the Moyle program, they were looking for money. I think that's true, but I think it was actually because of the Moyle program, because part of it was also they started building buildings everywhere because they looked and said, we got all these branches out there and we bring people out and there's like 14 people and half of them, you know, are weirdos and we're in somebody's living room, that what we need is we need to show the church like it is in Utah. So they start building all these chapels everywhere. And it was that program that, as you hinted at, that led the church to close its finances in the mid-60s, and they've been closed ever since because they were basically running deficits and going bankrupt on this program. So it was the kitty baps as well as this program of, we are so awesome. And the church stumbles over this from time to time. We are so awesome that if we just make this movie where they just see six of us, they're all going to want to join the church in droves. Who wouldn't want to meet the Mormons? And there it goes.
Yeah, and I will say that from what I know about this, there are several stories of sort of unauthorized rogue mission presidents doing the same thing. I've heard about it in Japan, and I've heard about it in other areas where they think that if you can, like, trick people into it, then they'll come. And so they set up, you know, sort of these trick scenarios to get people to come.
Well, there's not big barriers as a missionary. To get somebody baptized, you basically just have to have your district leader approve it, which just a missionary's been out about 6 weeks longer than you have. So it's not hard. I remember from my mission, there were these two elders that were in downtown San Diego. I was in the slums because I was with the refugees, and these guys were baptizing like crazy. But I met these guys. They were not like typical Mormons. You know, they were beer drinking missionaries. And there were other missionaries who called up, and every mission, you know, is these sort of guys, you know, other missionaries called up and said, these guys are kind of bad. They're kind of dinking around and sleeping around and doing stuff. And the mission president, this was a friend of mine who told me this story. The mission president said, do you realize how many baptisms they have? And hung up on them. So I think this thing has come up.
So you're saying that beer is a good tactic to get converts?
I'm drinking Diet Coke because I'm sitting next to it. No, what I'm saying is that the incentive to cheat the system in the way that Moyle sort of encouraged church-wide is still there, and it keeps popping its head up over and over again, right?
Well, and I don't think that it's like Moyle or someone saying like explicitly, you should promise kids a trip to Disneyland, you know, essentially, and get them baptized. But here you are, you're putting all this pressure on 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, and you're asking, you know, you're leaving it to them, to these young men, and saying, go and make sure you get baptisms. Well, we are talking about an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old young man, and so he's going to do what he thinks is kosher or right, and it's just like, that's where we get a little messy, is by giving so much, putting pressure on, and then giving so much responsibility to these young people to...
That's where we get Joseph Smith having intimate relations with the frog. See what I did there, Toby Wheeler? That was a musical reference just for you.
Did you just say intimate relations with a frog?
I have problems with that musical. I was not going to quote the musical directly.
Have you seen it?
I have. Let's talk about that later, John.
Oh my goodness. Lindsay has a secret life I don't even know about. So yeah, the baseball baptisms. There was tons of pressure. I was a missionary from 92 to 94. Tons of pressure for numbers. And they would always give a wink, wink, you know, stay in school, no numbers, but there was a lot of pressure. And they would say things, honest to God, they would say things with a wink, like, the missionaries who work the hardest get the prettiest wives.
My husband called them mission points.
Mission points. But there was tons.
He did, for real. He's like, I tracked it a lot in the rain, so... I took that as a compliment.
Oh. You're his trophy wife? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I was. It was purchased with mission points. It's the new 8 cow. So let's move on to number 2. I'm going to open this one with some intrigue. You ready? Okay. On April 29th, 1965, I'm going to take you back. BYU President Ernest L. Wilkinson makes his first reference in his diary to receiving reports from student spies that he had authorized and which became a national scandal within 10 months. Today, number 2, we're going to be talking about the Wilkinson spy ring of 1966. This is a great, great story. And there's a dialogue article if you want to read it about it in depth. And actually, D. Michael Quinn tried to link this to Ezra Taft Benson, which is a whole other story. And, there's this whole scare during this sort of Red Scare, right? This is over the remnants of the Red Scare. And basically, I'll give you the gist and then I'll let you guys say what you want to say about it. But the president of BYU, Ernest Wilkinson, is getting concerned with the creeping liberalism, you know, that is inundating BYU and larger culture. And he's super, super conservative. So he decides he's going to root out the evil. And what he does is he's going to give this speech at BYU. He tells his assistant that he's going to give this speech that is going to basically shake the walls or something. I can't remember his exact quote. And what it's meant to do is deliberately infuriate and piss off the liberal professors. He wants to draw them out and figure out who they are because he believes that they might be communists. So he gives a speech, and then his assistant goes grooms, but that doesn't sound right. He collects 10 students to be spies. So the students, after the speech, are supposed to go to these liberal professors and kind of, you know, find out information from them to see what their reactions are. So he gives a speech, the students do it, he collects this information, It's going just as he plans. And one of the people he charges is a professor named Ray Hilliam. He was a BYU political scientist, and he was one of the targeted professors. And he sort of finds out that the students are doing this, and he actually, Wilkinson actually will charge him officially with being a communist and disloyal to BYU. And so Hilliam starts to figure out where this information is coming from, and he gets some of the students to kind of admit that they're involved in this. Of course, the students are torn. They feel like they're part of this loyalty to not only their school professor or their school president, but they also feel like it's to God, because Wilkinson thinks this is totally connected to Mormon doctrine. He thinks he is, like, divinely inspired to do this. And it becomes this big, big, huge deal. Of course, it makes national news. It becomes a big scandal. So there's a whole complicated story behind it, but I would recommend reading the dialogue article, which talks about all this intrigue. There's going back and forth, and then there's this huge major fallout, and of course it gets linked to Ezra Taft Benson, and that causes problems actually for Mike Quinn later on.
Yeah, and in 2 weeks we're going to go through this in detail, but yeah, you had the holy trinity of Ernie Wilkinson, Ezra Benson, and Cleon Skousen at the time. They were just drumming up this communist fear that was going throughout the whole country. But you can thank Ernie Wilkinson for much of Mormon culture these days, like the things about facial hair and haircuts on missions and just all sorts of weirdness came out of that era. My father went on a mission in 61 to 63, and there's pictures of him. He was in Germany. He wearing a beret, right? Like we associate so much control with the missionary, you know, paradigm. But it was really modeling them off of G-Men. And Ernie Wilkinson loved, what's his name, the cross-dressing FBI director? Hoover, yes. And so a lot of those Hooveristic tactics of how Hoover was grooming FBI agents and these sort of weird things that were going on at the university were part of that grand anti-communist conspiracy. And it was real, and it was dirty down there at BYU. And there are still people who, as you say, to this day have suffered the effects. And you've heard me before kind of lament the September 6th. Is it September 7th yet? Has John DeLynn got his place with the September 6th? Yeah. The September 6th, really the shame of that story is it covers up the purges that were going on at BYU at the time, which to me were bigger and more monumental and had a bigger effect than some of the yahoos who were part of the September 6th.
I do want to read this quote from Ray Hilliam, who was one of the targeted professors. He was at BYU since 1916. He says, "Wilkinson politicized the campus with his perverted brand of conservatism, particularly after his bid for the U.S. Senate. And he would bring right-wing speakers to campus and gave high politically charged speeches," which doesn't sound that much different than what happens today.
Oh, there, you have to read some of those Benson talks. And you know, like David O. McKay has become a darling of the Mormon left these days, but he was just as bad. He was a racist, anti-communist, and he encouraged Benson, and he's the reason Benson never got slapped. Some of the talks from BYU Speech of the Year on anti-civil rights and they're racist, they're xenophobic, they're terrible.
Yeah. It's a good story. It's a good one. And like John said, if we do a third parter, or maybe when you're talking about the Red Scare, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so number three is the Mormon Sex and Chains case. Do any of you guys know this one? I don't want to say a fantastic story because it involves rape. That's right. Lindsay's bringing back the rape tonight to Mormon Expression. But actually, this is a scandal that has still become like this international sort of gossip tabloid piece. So what it's about is this young man who went on a mission to England. His name was Kirk Anderson, and he served his mission in England in 1977. Now, you can read all kinds of stuff. Like, I followed this rabbit hole all the way down. That was a bad analogy. You can follow this story to some interesting places. I'm not sure that there's a good way to frame this, actually. So, So anyway, he supposedly meets this woman named Joyce McKinney. Mm-hmm. And if you look at her now, she got super famous from this. She did a nude spread, I think even for Playboy or something, or for a British magazine. But anyway, she was this blonde bombshell, and that's what they call it. So she claims, so Anderson is on, his mission, and he claims he's abducted on the steps of a church meeting house by her. He claims that he's chained to a bed and raped repeatedly by this woman. And when he finally gets out, I think it's like 3 days later, he tries to tell people about it. And of course, people laugh. They're like, what? Men can't be raped by a woman, especially a hot one. That can't happen. And so it becomes this huge scandal. She becomes arrested and charged, but she denies the charges. She's like, I like this guy. Like, he was just super innocent and he wanted it. And of course, Anderson said, no, I was held against my will. And it becomes really embarrassing for him. And I think it's actually a really sad story because I think he has to face certain scrutiny that, female rape victims would not have to face because he's a man. So, you know, people are asking him how it worked, how that would happen. And it's super, you know, super embarrassing for him. And this woman, McKinney, actually goes on to do interviews about it. There's a made for TV movie about it. And she does all these articles and books.
There's a documentary on Netflix you can watch.
Oh, what's it called?
I think it's called Mormon and Handcuffs or Mormon or something. But I've watched the documentary.
And so, yeah, when you read the tabloid news at the time, it kind of makes it sound like he was just this innocent missionary, but he really kind of wanted it. And, so it was really him just feeling guilty about it later, which if we applied that same logic to a female rape victim, I think a lot of people would be like, what? That's terrible. You can't say that stuff. And actually, McKinney, she does some crazy stuff later on. She does this. She comes to America. She flees to America under cloak and dagger. She like has these elaborate disguises that she wears and, does all this crazy stuff. And basically, the story kind of goes away. And then in 1984, she pops up again and is accused of stalking Anderson, the same missionary guy. Who is now at this point married and has 3 kids. He's trying to stay under the radar. He's just like this nice real estate guy, doesn't want to talk about it. So she gets arrested for that, I think. And then, I think in 2008, she appears in the media for being one of the first people to have her dog cloned in Korea. So she makes the news again for that story. So I think it's a really interesting story. I mean, it's kind of funny to laugh at, but it's actually a really terrible, sad thing. To talk, and it really brings out these interesting dynamics about rape. So I don't want to make a joke about that.
Why do you say make a joke about rape and immediately look my way? I'm not going to touch that one. You know what I actually think is really sad about this? I'm going to bring the room down a bit. What I think is sad about this story is people are fascinated with the story. Did you all know that 2 missionaries in Texas were chopped up and eaten?
Save it for the next one.
Everybody knows this fucking story about this missionary who was raped, right? And we talk about it, make documentaries. 2 young men in Texas were chopped up and eaten by somebody. Anybody know their names? It's just this weird fascination that Mormons have in particular with sex, right? That's funny. It's real. Look it up.
When did this happen?
It happened in the 70s. They found they you can read about the they found the guy who had chopped up and eaten other. This is true. Stop laughing. This is terrible. This is horrific. That he had their clothes and he had done this to other people. So
that is terrible.
You did not expect me to go there, did you? I one-upped your man rape with cannibalism.
We are awful, awful people.
My goodness. There's something deeply wrong with this world and this panel. Okay, so bring us to number 4, Misha.
Which one's number 4? My bad, I didn't number them.
Domestic abuse.
Okay.
There goes Lindsay's career.
So this one's even less funny than the cannibalism. So Joseph F. Smith was an abusive husband. I think that that's, I don't know, I think it's shocking. At the same time, it's not, because he was known for his really bad temper. Of course, this is the son of Hiram Smith, and both of his parents were dead by the time he was 15, and after that he kind of became a wild child, had to drinking and smoking and getting in fights with teachers and other kids, and it was kind of a wild one.
It wasn't really that frowned on at the time. I mean, this was the Wild West, right?
Right. So, I mean, you know, this is a different time. This is late 1800s. So, I mean, yeah, different time, but he was a kind of a wild kid, went on a mission, and that kind of helped straighten him out a little bit. But his wife, when he got back from Hawaii, Lavera, they had this really kind of tumultuous relationship. It kind of seemed really love-hate, kind of Mr. and Mrs. Smith type of thing, which I don't want to make light of that, the fact that he abused her, but they really did have this thing where they were kind of fiercely connected and yet all over the place. And she was kind of suffered with some mental illness stuff, depression and things like that. And so he always said that she was just a very difficult wife. Well, one night, you know, he said, if you hear any weird noises, don't go outside, because apparently what he says later is that she would always hear weird noises. Like maybe she had voices in her head or something. They didn't have the language for that then, but she would always hear noises, and then she would go outside in her nightie and whatever and make a scene. And he didn't like that. So he would just stay in bed. Well, one night she heard a noise, and she went out and looked, and he was like, what did I tell you? You should have stayed inside. And then he beats her with a rope. And which he said, it wasn't a rope, it was a peach branch, is what he said.
That was his defense?
Yeah, oh. Yeah, that it was a
there's
peach
an
branch.
Actually, are you going to talk about this, that there's an actual legal reason why he says that?
Oh, I wasn't, but do you want to?
So you know the term rule of thumb? Do you know where that comes from?
Oh, right, yeah.
It comes from the idea, I think, if you beat your wife with something that's thicker than your thumb,
then it's illegal.
Then it's illegal.
That's right.
So that's why he makes this justification, because he's like, it wasn't a rope. It was just a little twig.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. That's where the rule of thumb thing comes from. But she wasn't hearing voices. She was hearing singers out in the neighborhood, actually. And so it was just this kind of this ugly scene. He was 23 at the time, which is no excuse, but is said that his temper kind of calmed down in his later years, but they continued to have problems throughout their marriage, and eventually they got divorced, and because he would just go into rages all the time. She once was with another man just visiting. Apparently he was reading to her or something like that, and he flew off the handle and got really upset and called her a whore and all these other things, and he had beat up a neighbor once. And so he really had a temper, which is interesting, because of course he was the one who was kind of the first teacher of don't beat your children, as far as in over the pulpit. It was like, we don't need to beat our children, you know, we shouldn't be violent, that type of a thing,
as long as it's not a rope.
Right, exactly. Yeah, maybe beat your kid with a peach branch and you're okay.
So. Well, and there's a great Sunstone article on that if you want to read it in detail. Do you have the title of it?
I didn't write down the title, but if you just Google Joseph F. Smith domestic violence, that article comes right up.
The Smiths were a wild bunch. Him and his cousins, of course, were down the patriarch's line, and they were into alcohol and buggery and all sorts of fun things. I wonder, did that later influence their, well, let's see. Joseph F. Smith was the father of Joseph Fielding Smith, who is the father-in-law of Bruce R. McConkie, who was they're related to Worthland or something so I guess the influence is still there. Maybe there's still exciting things happening in Salt Lake. I doubt it, but maybe.
Perhaps.
I don't know why we'd worry about that when there are missionaries that have been eaten alive.
They weren't alive when they got eaten. They got cut off into pieces.
I don't think I'm going to get over that story. Thank you, John. Okay, Katrine, I think you're up for
it's
number
terrible.
Five.
It's terrible. Like, nobody knows.
It
nobody
is. It's
talks
a
about
really
it.
Sad story, John.
Tracking is dangerous. You can get eaten.
Okay, I'll take it from there. I don't know what number five, what scandal am I?
So this is the use of strychnine and arsenic.
Oh, okay. A lot of people don't know that the early pioneers are actually well known for their use of poison. A lot of there is rumor and history of poisonings in Nauvoo and some in Salt Lake, I believe. Even my own family history, there's rumors of a family member being poisoned by other Mormons. So this runs
Joseph
deep.
Smith was also accused of it. I think, is it, there's a historian, yes. I want to say it's Johnny Stevenson, who's chronicling all of the poisons by Joseph Smith, supposedly.
Yes. And didn't he even accuse, Brigham Young accused Emma Smith of poisoning Joseph Smith? I believe.
Joseph believed that.
Joseph believed it.
Well, was it Samuel who, his brother, Joseph's brother, who died, who was supposed to be digging a well in the basement and then got sick?
He died a couple weeks after he brought his, Joseph and Hiram home. He died a couple, brought their bodies home after they died. He died a couple weeks later, and his wife, who's actually married my grandfather, believed that, Samuel was poisoned by the doctor.
Well, William claimed, that his brothers were poisoned by Brigham, I think.
Well, Tom Kimball, I have not seen the source on this, but Tom Kimball told me that you were more likely to die from poison in the Nauvoo Legion than from anything else.
It's a wild time.
So that leads us to the poor Goshute Indians in Tooele Valley. They actually were kind of a picked-on tribe. The Paiutes and the Navajo gave them a hard time and really picked on them. And then along came the Mormons to make things worse.
Or to convert and baptize them, you mean?
Yeah, either convert or we'll kill you, I guess. But in 1845, there was a militia captain named William McBride who conducted a ruthless campaign into Willow Valley that killed 11 Goshutes. He made a request that he sent to Salt Lake City, and I'll read it. "We wish you without a moment's hesitation to send us about a pound of arsenic. We want to give the Indians' well a flavor. Also a spade to dig for water. A little strychnine would be a fine service and instead of salt to their too fresh meat." After signing the report, McBride added a postscript. "Don't forget the arsenic. Don't forget the spade and arsenic. Don't forget the spade, strychnine, and arsenic." So I think he made it clear what his intentions were. So, yeah, that is the Goshutes that were poisoned by the pioneers for being on the property before they were. 1851. Did I say 1845? Yeah, 1851. Sorry if I said the wrong. Oh, 1845 is when the Illinois neighbors start claiming the pioneers, that Mormons were poisoning them in Illinois. 1851 is Tooele.
So we forget, because the schools have been teaching it falsely to us, that the Mormons didn't arrive in the valley with nobody here, right? Nobody was in the Salt Lake Valley at the time. Of course, Ogden was up in Ogden, right? So we forget this, there was a full white settlement in Ogden. Like we just brush this over all the time. And in the school textbook says, they were up there. And then in the Provo Valley, which is probably the most fertile valley, there was a full-on settlement of Ute Indians. And then in the Tooele Valley, there's a full settlement of Goshute Indians. And then the second settlement, after they came to Salt Lake, the second settlement, because these other places were populated by Indians, landed Indians, not just like nomadic Indians, but they went down to the Sanpete Valley, where down in Ephraim Manti, that was a second Mormon settlement. And of course, there were Indians all around there. So the
that's why you have to poison them, John. So well, that's go what, away.
The Mormons immediately found themselves in land wars against this population. But what's fascinating is school kids in Utah can tell you about the Battle of Crooked River that happened in Missouri, right? Even though they don't really know what happened. They don't talk about the judge getting shot in the belly or anything like that. But they can tell you about that. They can tell you about what happened in Kirtland, Ohio, in Nauvoo. But the same level of bloodiness followed the Mormons for the next, 100 years. My great grandfather, he was in Sanpete. I remember going down there in the early 80s and the 70s, listening to tell stories of killing Indians. And these things went, way into the early part of the 20th century. And it was a bloody, bloody time. And we've just sort of forgotten it all. And matter of fact, there's still roadside stands around here that haven't been, they'll be taken down in the next 10 years, I guarantee. But you can still find them that commemorate like these massacres. And you're like, well, who's massacring who? Like, why
yeah,
is there...
Yeah, there's one. There's one if you're going down to Fountain Green. I think it's tied in with the Black Hawk War, but I grew up stopping there with my grandparents every time to learn about how these poor settlers had died. And actually, they found out when they were uncovering it since then that there are mass graves of Native people. Like, it's... We like to talk about Mountain Meadows being, like, the worst massacre on U.S. soil. That does not talk about the genocide Mormons perpetuated.
It's the worst massacre of white people. I mean...
Right.
And...
But we... I mean, it's absolutely accurate to say that it's been, you know, centuries of genocide. And Mormons were no stranger to it. So this is a really sad story. Let's go on to number six.
This is a downer list, by the way, Lindsay.
It is.
You're bringing me down,
man. This should have lots of trigger warnings. I talk about this on my polygamy podcast. So if you listen to that, I'm sorry for the repeat, but this is an interesting one. So I'm going to lead you in with some more intrigue. There's an account in Hosea Stout's diary, which reads, Saturday, 27th of February, 1858. This evening, several persons disguised as Indians entered Henry Jones's house and dragged him out of bed with a whore and castrated him by a square and close amputation. We're going to be talking about the Southern Utah castrations. And this is a controversial one that, for many reasons, good reasons, a lot of scholars don't like to talk about. But some scholars have talked about this.
Because it gives them the heebie-jeebies?
Yeah, it's a dark doctrine. So we're talking the 1850s, late 1850s, right after Mountain Meadows, right after the Mormon Reformation, and people are just on fire. They're getting rebaptized. They're having these evangelical is the wrong word. They're having all these like Pentecostal experiences. And, there's this bishop in Manti. His name is Bishop Snow, and he was Bishop Warren Snow, and you can look him up. And he was famously known for, wanting to take on another plural wife. He was already married, I think, to 11 women at the time.
From the same family that the university down there is named after, Snow College.
I never put that together, but I think you're right. So he's this bishop, and everybody was scared of him anyway. He was, you can trace him back to Kirtland and Nauvoo. He was a bodyguard to the actual Nauvoo Legion. He was a guy that they knew could do stuff for the leaders at any given moment. So he wants this young woman as a plural wife. She's said to be beautiful, and she's engaged to another man. And so what happens is Bishop Snow brings him in and says, hey, you're going to go on a mission, and I'm going to marry this girl. And he's like, no, we're engaged. It's too late. And there are several different accounts that are kind of questionable, but from what my opinion is gathering is that the girl was afraid. So how she expressed herself to the bishop was probably under duress, saying, yeah, I'd really like to marry you, but it's too late. I'm already married, or I'm already engaged. We know that Warren Snow, takes this guy there. So there are several different accounts of this. John D. Lee talks about riding off in the bushes, ambushing this guy in the woods. There are several different versions of this, and it could mean that there were more than one person involved with this. So they take this young man, basically they kidnap him, bring him into the schoolhouse, they strap him down to the bench, they cut off his member, and they tack it to the school, wall. And it said that people had to go and attend church in that same building the next day, and it was a reminder. Well, Salt Lake gets word of this because people are outraged. You know, they're like, that is too much. This guy is already too power hungry. And it said that that Brigham Young was like, eh, that was a crappy move. He shouldn't have done it, but he's a good guy. Let's give him a pass on this, right? So it starts to kind of, Warren Snow starts to lose a little bit of favor with Brigham Young, but he's totally given a pass. And this is actually documented. You can read the documents of Brigham Young saying it's no big deal. He retains his status. And this wasn't the only castration. This was the Blood Atonement Doctrine. They would do this to people that they believed were sexual predators. They would do it for people found in incest. The Hosea Stout account that I gave you, Henry Thomas, they call him Torn Thomas. And he was allegedly having an affair with his own mother. Now, that's something that could have been attached to the story later on to kind of scandalize it and justify what happened. But what happens is we do know that he and his mother flee town. And I think it's Porter Rockwell that chases him down and castrates him right there and then. And they slit the throat of the mother in blood atonement fashion. And then I think they leave the guy alive. I can't remember how that story ends. You can listen to my podcast on it. But yeah, it's really, really dark stuff. So that was happening in southern Utah. It was a dark time, and there are several accounts of this happening.
Well, polygamy rose up a lot of dark things that don't get talked about. And one is, you know, for example, the powerful men would try to place a wife along the Mormon corridor so they had a place to stay as they traveled the circuit. So the 12 would not only just have a bevy of wives, or what do you measure wives in? What is the, is it a gaggle?
I believe they're called celestial jewels in your eternal crown. Okay. I'm not making that up.
All right. I know it's not a coven, but you have wives all over the place, but I said it's not. Lindsay, don't make that face at me. So you'd have these, and then people would be sent off on missions and da 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 da. By the underground accounts, there was a lot of hanky panky going on. Because first of all, they were all human beings, but secondly, there was a lot of lonely women around and people who were willing to grant them the reprieve from their loneliness. And it got kind of nutty down there.
Nutty. That's a great word for this.
Yeah. So, yeah, I would recommend, not to plug my podcast, but I'm going to do it. Listen to this. It's the Santa Clara, Southern Utah episode, and it's pretty dark stuff. So let's move on to number 7. This is also a downer, Katrine.
Okay. I guess that means the aversion therapy?
Yeah, not you. You're an upper.
Okay. I'm glad I'm the upper. But we are going to continue talking about male members. And this actually began when it was believed that homosexuality was a mental illness, not just by the church, but in the world in general. Well, Spencer W. Kimball grabbed onto that, and other leaders grabbed onto the mental illness part and decided that it could be cured. And so BYU began their own studies. And in 1976, there was a study called The Effect of Visual Stimuli in Electric Aversion Therapy. So they would take these young men, I saw the youngest 15 up to 30-something, and they would take them into a room. They would show them pictures of male pornography. And let me read it.
So wait, let's take a couple steps back.
Okay.
These young men would go to their bishops,
yes,
and confess that, yes, they had homosexual thoughts.
They would confess, and not only that, the reason they were put in this is either the men felt so guilty about who they were that they were like, please, I'll do anything. I want to get help. I want to be fixed. Or their family members would kind of push them into it, so they would take these perfectly healthy, mind and body healthy individuals and push them into this study.
Because even when I was at BYU, there was a letter that went around that got exposed. Are you even listening, Lindsay?
No, I'm still trying not to laugh.
I threw you a bone.
Kind of chopped up missionaries.
Okay, so there's a letter that came out that went to all the BYU bishops that said, it is your ecclesiastical duty to report to the university when students, confess to you, sins that would put their student status in question. And most of the bishops said, fuck you, I'm not going to tell you that kind of stuff. So some poor kid goes into his bishop, confesses, assuming some sort of ecclesiastical protection, and that he's going to be cared for, and then he gets turned over to the BYU Stasi. I want to make sure that's clear up front before they drag him down into the basement and hook the electrodes up.
Right. Right. And there's actually the man I read about, his name is John Cameron, and he was he is the head of the acting division in the University of Iowa. And I read his story, and he actually said that these people that were helping him, he thought they were his savior, and they were really going to help him and make him better and correct his problem, because he felt so guilty about it. So he enrolled for this 3 to 6 month course of therapy, and he did it willingly because he wanted to be normal. So they would take this mercury-filled tube and place it around the base of the penis to measure the level of stimulation he experienced when viewing nude images of men and women. And so if he was getting too much stimulus, they would shock him. And there are other people that said that they would be in charge of the shocking. So they would tell the young men, "Hey, if you really want to be fixed, you should give yourself a good shock, you know. And if you only want a little bit of fixing, just me." But it is a horrific thing. And if you go onto YouTube, you can watch these men talk about these accounts, and they are just traumatized. I don't understand why there was no charges brought against
BYU.
But it
worked, right? They're totally not gay now, right?
Yeah, they're totally fine now. There's no sexual problem now. But, and I'm saying that sarcastically, of course. But there were also, to go along with the electric shock, there was something they called vomit therapy, where if they were watching the images and they got excited, they had an IV that they would put some kind of medication in that would make them vomit. So see a naked image, you'd vomit. And it was just to try to correct their thinking that...
So let's be completely clear and honest. The things that you saw in A Clockwork Orange, BYU was really honest to God doing those. They were strapping these guys down. They were electrocuting them. They were forcing them to vomit. They were making them watch gay porn. They were doing all these things. It is absolutely horrific. And the people who were involved, no prison time. They're still around.
Nothing.
The poor guys who I've had occasion to meet, one of them, they're traumatized. I mean, this was a terrible thing. It ruined their lives.
Yeah. There was one boy that said that he went and confessed to his bishop, or it was actually his seminary teacher, confessed to his seminary teacher. His seminary teacher told his parents, told his bishop, told stake president. They enrolled him in BYU. He had never looked at pornography. He'd never looked at a naked male, never touched, never anything. And yet they were strapping an electric shock to his penis. I can't imagine the horror, and I can't imagine the parents' perspective thinking that their child was so broken that they had to do this. It's just,
and not only that, but there were other aspects of this program that would still remain long after they got rid of the electroshock therapy, where they would have these trusted male counselors, I'm using counselors in air quotes, who were also gay themselves, usually, or not, who had other problems, and they would become, they were working on the theory that, you know, boys were gay because they didn't have strong father figures. So this person would come in and try to be this father figure. And it was this really like sick mental game of giving these boys projects and things to think about and things to do. And I will say, although I'm super glad that electroshock therapy isn't happening today, there is still reparative therapy. So everyone wants to shy away from that word, but that is basically the idea that your sexual identity can be fixed or changed or course corrected.
Well, and of course, this stuff is around still today in terms of so-called sexual addiction camps and therapy in the state for boys who've looked at pornography. And the same mentality of trying to fix that and mislabeling common use as addiction. And these same roots are still there.
Are you talking about straight sex there also, or just still on homosexual?
Oh, they actually lump in. I know members that go to this. They lump in gay men with straight men with sex addiction. It's the kind of the same thing. You can
and also with the pedophiles and other.
I'm
horrendous.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Because we have a really good grasp on sexuality as far as Mormons.
Well, and I'll just say that this like hits home and like makes me really upset and sick because, of course, I work at the counseling center at BYU and. I just see the progress that we've made, and is it perfect? No, but absolutely no reparative therapy happens
at
BYU's counseling center. It does not happen.
I'm glad you said that. Sorry, I didn't want to conflate that. Yeah, there are groups like Evergreen who I think they're trying to distance themselves from that term, right? Reparative therapy.
Yeah, isn't Evergreen just a gay hookup site now? Like where gay Mormon guys go to find other gay Mormon guys?
Yeah, I'm not qualified enough that I want to talk about it, but yeah, that's a sad one. Let's talk about number 8. Misha, this is you and the LeBarons.
All right. So, more missionaries gone rogue here. We'll talk about. So, this is 1958, the Paris, France mission. And this is an interesting story. So, William Tucker, who was a very successful missionary and became the the AP or the assistant. Is that what
assistant to the president?
Mm-hmm. So he's right under the mission president. Mission president has a lot of confidence in him. Well, while he's out on his mission, he's doing a lot of researching on his own and thinking a lot about what he believes. And he comes to believe that, polygamy is doctrine and that it should be practiced. And, also that there's a higher order of the priesthood. Like, this isn't, we don't have the straight priesthood. There's more. And he's interested in getting it. Well, so he kind of starts this mission in a mission thing, and he starts telling all the other missionaries. So, of course, he has contact with them all because he's the mission president's assistant. And he convinces about one third of them, and there's 130, convinces about a third of them to jump on board with this idea. And so they're, all these missionaries are going out and teaching about polygamy, and they're teaching, you know, all these other things. And this comes from the, a lot of their information was coming from, LeBaron, who, his first name I always, Ervil LeBaron, who, of course, Ervil LeBaron is the guy who put out a hit on his brother and killed him. He was a Mormon. He left the church to practice polygamy, started the colonies down in Mexico.
And if you want to be a polygamist, your name better be Ervil.
Right? LeBaron. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, Tucker is getting information from LeBaron on here's what the real deal needs to be, and this is how you do it. So, when all the missionaries go to the London, temple dedication, the church leaders start kind of hearing whisperings of what's going on. And so they start bringing these missionaries in and interviewing them and like, what's going on? Do you believe that President McKay is the president, the prophet? And then people, that's kind of where they got hung up because they're like, oh, I don't know. And so they, several of them, ended up repenting and saying, all right, I was wrong. Tucker's crazy and I'm sorry, we're not going to do polygamy. And, but nine of them were excommunicated and nine missionaries, and they ended up going down to Mexico and being part of the LeBaron's church. And Tucker, actually, he was there for a little while and was an apostle or pretty high up in this sect. But then he left and died an atheist. He died in 1967. And actually, another mission president came down and kind of made an announcement like, you know, Elder Tucker has passed away. And like the missionaries had heard that name and they're like, oh, okay. So they kind of knew what it meant. Like it was a big scandal and it made missionary work really, really tough in the Paris area. People didn't really trust the missionaries. What they were getting, is this really what the Mormons are peddling or is it not? And so caused a lot of controversy.
But. And I do want to say one thing, like we like to think like, oh, those crazy missionaries, like, practicing polygamy, wanting to think that that's the true church. After researching polygamy, there is actually really good doctrinal basis for these guys to believe what they believe. So when we want to make fun of fundamentalists, it's like, guys, there's a good case to be made that they're living the true Mormonism.
I heard about this story that had to do with in France, Tucker there in France, and I asked my dad about that because he was a missionary in France, probably after Tucker's time, but, well, definitely after his time, but it soured the entire, all over France and probably all over Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. It really did kind of, it was kind of a stain for the church that they're these missionaries.
I mean, I hate to call you guys out, but I think you're just repeating the bullshit you've been told by the church, right? Like, the reason the church didn't take root in France is not because of the LeBarons. It's because the church is crazy. Right. Like, there's the LeBarons had never come along. It's not like there'd be, like, these big, like, temples dotting the
Norman
Ocean
side. Foiled by polygamy again. Yes.
Fair enough.
Okay, let's do...
When I saw LeBarons, I thought you were going to talk about Ervil LeBaron and the murders.
Well, that's really not a Mormon scandal.
Yeah, I was kind of.
I don't know that I buy your church.
I know a lot of people lost their faith because of that scandal.
You believe the Book of Mormon is true and Joseph Smith is a prophet. You're a fucking Mormon. period.
Sure, but John, we haven't practiced polygamy since 1890.
Oh, bullshit.
Well, that's something maybe we can talk about later. Or you could, we'll be definitely talking about that on my series coming up. I'm having lots of great plugs tonight. This is awesome.
I think the thing to know is that the fundamentalists from wherever they come from, and there's these complex interwoven genealogies and intrafighting or whatever. You know, when you watch Big Love and something really crazy happens on that show and you're like, oh my God, that couldn't happen. All that stuff really did happen. It just didn't all happen to one family.
Or probably worse. I mean, there's some crazy stuff out there.
Yeah. So LeBarons are a name of infamy. In this area.
I just think of pizza, like frozen pizza.
Like the Red Baron?
Yeah.
Like Snoopy?
LeBaron pizza. Delicious. Okay. So, Katrine, do you want to take us to number 9?
Yes. I am talking about the Morisites, and that is one thing. I'd never heard of this scandal. In 1857, a man comes from England as a convert. His name is Joseph Morris. And eventually, he has this revelation that he believes he's the seventh angel from the Book of Revelations. So he writes Brigham Young, hey, I'm an angel. Brigham Young says, yeah, not on my turf, and he's excommunicated. Well,
he's lucky he wasn't killed. Or castrated or something.
That's what I thought. It's like,
he should have brought his flaming sword.
Who would ever dare to tell Brigham Young anything?
Lot of people who were threatened that Brigham Young and his minions said, get out of town. Tell Dawn basically to head back.
Oh, hundreds of people.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
So he starts to build up a following though, and, they become the Morisites because you always put ite under whatever. So they're the Morisites. And in 1861, they build a church called the Church of the Firstborn. And they move to an abandoned fort from the government called the Kingston Fort. And they begin to live there. And they gather all their stuff together and make this community pool, all the resources. Law of consecration, I suppose. And they believe the second coming's coming. So they don't even plant crops. It's even said they trampled on the crops because you don't need food if the Lord's coming, you know. So it doesn't happen. Amazing enough, the Savior does not appear. And so people slowly start to say, I'm out of here. And they begin to take their stuff out of the resources, like, you know, this is my chair or whatever. And they start to take these things. Well, some Morisites are watching some of the good stuff leaving. And they're thinking, wait, how come they get the good stuff and we're left with the crappy stuff? So they chase down some of these men, and they capture three men that leave named John Jensen, William Jones, and Lars C. Gjertsen. And they lock them up, and they tell them, you're not getting out until the Lord appears, and then he'll judge you. So one of the men does escape. Gjertsen escapes, but the wives of John Jensen and William Jones notify the Chief Justice and say, our husbands are being held captive. Things start to pick up, and a man named Robert T. Burton, who's the marshal, they say it's between 500 and 1,000 men to raid this, Kingston Fort to free these men. And he fires a warning shot. It actually it kills two women and wounds another. It becomes this battle, and then it ends when Morris approaches Burton, the marshal, and Burton kills Morris and two other women. For some reason, the women were targeted. I don't know. So, in the end, 7 of the Morisites are convicted of second-degree murder, and 66 are convicted of resistance. But interestingly enough, the territorial governor pardoned them 3 days later. So, nothing much happened to that. And then you can actually go... The Morisites scatter, and some of them build a Deer Lodge County in Montana. And you can still go there and see their house of worship. It's a little building. And interesting enough, maybe you'll know the reason, Lindsay, but the Daughters of Utah Pioneers have erected a plaque there about the Morisites and what happened. And I didn't know how the Daughters of Pioneer would be involved in that.
They're not just Mormon. They try not to be, but the Morisite leaders were originally Mormon. There are some famous notable Mormons that followed them off, so that's probably why.
Okay. So that is the Morisites.
Yeah, the same thing happened with the Harmstromites, the ones who basically took over Manti in 99, because they were all waiting for Jesus to come, you know, with the Y2K bug. And it didn't happen, and they start pulling their property and stuff out of the collective. I think there's still lawsuits left over from that. They're still kind of down there, but they're not as well organized as they were prior to the millennium.
Are they the ones that are, like, buried in the mountains? Like in the rocks and stuff.
You'll have to get more specific on your crazy.
Are you talking about like Nephite gold?
No, they came out of the Ogden area and Roy and up there, and they started practicing polygamy. This was in the early 90s, like 93. And then they all moved down in mass down to Manti. If you go down to Manti today, you'll see a lot of holiness to the Lord on newer buildings. The old buildings have it. But those are Harmstromite, the True and Living Church, I think they call themselves. I don't know.
There's a True and Living Church?
Both, yes.
Wow, sign me up. Okay, if you've made it this far, you've made it all the way to number 10. And number 10 is something you might have heard of if you follow any of D. Michael Quinn's work. He writes a lot about this in Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, which is a very heavy book, but it's fantastic to read. And some of these sources are kind of based in rumor and conjecture, and some are not. I'm going to be talking about animal sacrifices in the temple. So it's alleged that Joseph Smith in his money digging days was into animal sacrifices, dog being one of his particular favorites. In the Magic Worldview, Michael Quinn says, quote, a cousin of Smith's wife, Emma, reported that Smith translated the Book of Mormon by means of the same peepstone and under the same inspiration that directed his enchantments and dog sacrifices. It was all by the same spirit, end quote. Now, of course, this was like a third-hand account, so that could be a problem. But there are many reports of black sheep being taken, sheep being stolen from Joseph Smith. He was into this sort of animal sacrifice way before he brings it into the Kirtland Temple. Now, there, for anyone that doesn't know, the temple ceremony has drastically changed from what it used to be. And of course, John C. Bennett writes about it early on and talks about how they're all naked doing sacrifices and all that kind of stuff. But actually, there is some good evidence to suggest that the animal sacrifices were happening in the temple. I came across a Kirtland Temple script where they talk about the sacrifice that Adam and Eve had to do on an altar with the lamb, and that this was something that they reenacted in the temple. And it's also said that, Brigham Young had plans to bring this to Utah. We know that in Wilford Woodruff's journal, he wrote on December 18, 1857, speaking of temple plan, under the pulpit in the west end, Aaronic priesthood end, will be a place to offer sacrifices. There will be an altar prepared to that purpose so that when any sacrifices are to be offered, they should be offered here or there, end quote. So Brigham wanted to bring the animal sacrifice element to Utah, but of course Brigham dies before he can see this temple completed. And if you want to go out there, there's plenty of sources that you can look at. Not plenty, but there are sources that you can look at and read this temple script. And it's this huge, big ritual based around animal sacrifices. And it's the sort of idea that blood needed to be spilt. Of course, we know this from Blood Atonement. But the sacrificing by the shedding of blood was instituted in the days of Adam, and of necessity will have to be restored because Joseph restored all things.
I was taught multiple times growing up in the church that, you know, with the restoration of all things, that at some point animal sacrifice would of necessity need to be restored. But sometimes they would say, oh, it's just going to happen once, you know, ceremonially or whatever. But I was never taught in church that this was okay, but I was taught that many times that it was a part of the restoration. You know, the sons of Levi or whatever they are going to come marching back with their baker hats on and do whatever else they're going to do. It's all getting foggy in my mind now. It all used to be so clear and not so much anymore.
I was never taught that, thank goodness. But I was also the little kid that wanted to be a vegan, and my family laughed at me. So it wouldn't have been appreciated. Okay, I think that's it. Do you guys want to say anything else about the top 10 lesser known scandals.
No, it's been fun.
Good times.
You're welcome for me adding cannibalism to your
list. I was going to say, you all need due diligence and go honor these men who were chopped up in meat and alive.
And you know what? This one was spawned by the last one because I talked about the three heads in the duffel bag and you said, stop, that's coming on the next list. There are no hooker heads on this list.
All right, well, I want to do a third. So if you guys are liking what you hear, then you can say that because, like I said, we have a lot of things to talk about. So
it was the frontier was a nasty place.
Unless you're Brigham Young and then. It was
so golden.
It was always, the church was always on the frontier, you know, Indian territory up where Joseph Smith was born, where he was raised. And then, of course, down to Kansas City, which was right on the border. And then Nauvoo, they literally built the town out of a swamp. Salt Lake City was in the middle of nowhere. You know, this is a church that was born and raised on the edge of society. And anybody who watches Walking Dead knows that that breeds a lot of violence and zombies.
Yes, zombies will also make it into our next one. So anyway, everyone, thanks for listening. Go ahead and make a donation at whitefieldseducational.org. Support this program and other great programs Whitefields is doing. And have a good night.
Thanks, Lindsay.
The Mormon Expression Podcast is recorded live before a studio audience in Salt Lake City on Tuesday nights at 6:30. Come down and join the audience, take part in the podcast, and meet John and the panelists. The Mormon Expression Podcast is produced by the Whitefield Educational Foundation. Visit us online at whitefieldseducational.org to find out about our counseling services and other special events.